At Yes Theory, we get a lot of out there emails. But in 2019, I got one that was next level. The subject line read, in all caps, by the way, great opportunity, must read, with 3 exclamation points afterwards. I absolutely thought it was some kind of phishing scam, so I held off opening it for weeks. But luckily, my curiosity was stronger than my interest in cybersecurity, so I opened it. It turns out this email was a legitimate invitation to meet the Dalai Lama. Yeah, the Dalai Lama. As if I didn't already realize, Matt made sure I knew how big of a deal this opportunity would be.
His whole life is like a history of the 20th and 21st century. FDR, President Roosevelt, gifted him a watch. That is so long ago. This man has met every important person to ever live in the last century and the century.
Oh, and there's one more thing the email said that I forgot to mention. Not only would I get to meet the Dalai Lama, but I would also get to ask him a question. One single question.
And he's probably been asked every single question that you can imagine. So you have to come up with something that is so different.
Thanks, Matt. No pressure. But as if thinking up the question wasn't complicated enough, I'd have to fly to the other side of the planet to present it to him, which felt like a lot of work. So I was thinking it was probably a no-go. Just kidding. We are Yes Theory, so I'm sure you can imagine what our answer was. When we arrived in Dharamshala, our editor, also named Thomas, and I spent the day exploring. I still hadn't figured out my question, so I was getting a bit desperate for inspiration. We spent hours visiting religious sites, admiring the Himalayas, and drinking chai. By the time it got dark, I still had nothing. So, on the very night before we were supposed to meet His Holiness, we sat down in a market, determined to figure this out.
On the plane, I actually made a list of questions. I know that you did too. I saw you doing that in the front seat.
Yeah. Yeah. You copied me or what?
No, I actually did
first. If you copied a single one of my questions, I'll come after you.
I mean, it's the Dalai freaking Lama. This was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I thought that this was our chance to ask something huge.
I guess the question that we can't guess the answer to. Like, meaning of life is going to say enlightenment, right?
Thomas, or as we call him Tommy, took another approach.
What's your favorite color?
Yeah, we're done.
Eventually, we narrowed down our options to 4 questions. I felt good about them and decided to go with whatever felt right in the moment. The next morning, I scouted out the strongest coffee I could find before Tommy and I walked across the street to the Dalai Lama's house, which fit exactly how you would envision the Dalai Lama's house to look like. Once inside, I had serious social anxiety about how to behave in this space. Was I an attendee? A participant? I was the opposite of Zen at this point, and then...
We found out last night that we're basically with a group here, and there's a lot of different parameters that are outside of our control, so...
They had invited 60 people, and we found out that they would only be allowing 6 questions. I'd been agonizing over my question for a whole week, only to find out that there was no guarantee I'd even get to ask it.
Arriving here, I honestly feel a little bit selfish, like, wanting to make sure I get my question. It's just tough to compromise with the feeling of, like, wanting to make sure we get what we came here for, but also not inch our way past all these people who also traveled really far away to come talk to him. So we're in a bit of a pickle at this moment.
There was nothing else left to do but just to show up, try to stay calm, and see what happened next. When His Holiness walked into the room, I felt a ripple of tension. It was as if all 60 of us had forgotten to breathe. As the Dalai Lama continued his walk to the front of the room, I exhaled. For someone whose presence I thought would be weighed with an air of gravity, he glided into the room with a light and easy presence. Like he was floating, even. Some of the attendees approached to offer him gifts, but he brushed them away. At the front of the hall sat a dais, decorated with bright flowers, and when the Dalai Lama reached it, he gestured for us to sit down. Then the questions started. The Dalai Lama responded as if he answered some of these inquiries thousands of times before. My stomach started doing backflips. The reality of the situation started to sink in. I'd traveled halfway across the world to ask a question that the Dalai Lama has probably already heard. Then the mic got passed to me.
Hi. Thank you so much for having us.
And I thought of our Yes Theory community and went with my gut.
There's a lot of people my age that struggle with anxiety and depression. And so my question to you is, if you had the ability to whisper in the ear a lesson to every single young person in the world, what would it be and why?
As soon as I asked, he looked over at his aide and kind of smirked, like it would be funny if it wasn't the Dalai Lama and he wasn't doing it to me. Then he turned and looked at me, his eyes boring holes through my skull. I honestly think I blacked out for a second.
Too much self-centered attitude. Me, 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 me. Then anxiety. Suspicion. The antidote of self-centered attitude, altruism. And consider rest of the human being. One human community. If I too much emphasis, I'm Tibetan, I'm Buddhist, I'm Dalai Lama. Then you yourself actually isolate by yourself. Then more anxiety.
He kept pointing at me as he said this, really to drive it home. I asked His Holiness a question about me, me, me. And in that moment, I could only think of me. I was embarrassed. It was hard to focus on what he was actually saying.
My main daily practice is practice of altruism. A very important factor for physical health, according to my own experience. Now I'm 84 years old. But my mind, some of my friends used to express, is quite young. So altruism, very, very helpful to reduce self-centered attitude. That automatically reduces anxiety, frustration. Thank you.
The Dalai Lama, unsurprisingly, gave me a lot to think about. So much so that I barely remember leaving Dharamsala. When I returned to Los Angeles, I kept circling back to what an altruistic life actually looks like. Like, was I even close to living one? The experience with the Dalai Lama totally altered my understanding of mental health and self-improvement. When it came to my own personal anxiety, my instinct was always to go off and handle it by myself. I never thought of altruism as a potential antidote, maybe because even that idea felt selfish. I realized that the question I should have asked all along was this: how do we better show up for each other? From Headspace Studios, I'm Thomas Bragg.
I'm Amar Kandil.
And I am Matt Daher.
This is the Yes Theory Podcast, and today we're talking about kindness. More in just a minute.
You decided to upgrade your outdoor deck, so you ordered the essentials: a power washer, a set of patio chairs, and a shiny new grill. And you use your Bank of America Cash Rewards credit card, choosing to earn 3% cash back on online shopping, or up to 5.25% as a preferred rewards member, which you put towards the cost of your most essential deck addition, a bird feeder. Apply for yours at bankofamerica.com/more rewarding. Copyright 2020 Bank of America Corporation.
No matter how insecure or anxious I felt at the Dalai Lama's house, his answer affirmed a lot of what we've always believed at Yes Theory: that every human on the planet wants to belong, and that our highest calling in life is simply to serve and connect with others. At times, we've struggled to keep that vision front and center, and that's often when things start to spiral, when our ego obscures our core beliefs in creating meaningful connections. It's harder to show up in those moments, for each other as friends, or for anyone. But inevitably, we find the ground again and remember, Yes Theory is not a YouTube channel, or three faces, or about us. It's about you. Yes Theory isn't some perfectly altruistic endeavor. We aren't knights or saints or the Dalai Lama. We're human and we battle the very same things that you do. I mean, why do you think we started this podcast? Because these are the lessons that we needed to hear. So really the question is, if we believe what the Dalai Lama said, how can we make service a real priority? How can we clear our egos out of the way on a more consistent basis? The answer is simpler than you think. No, really, like kindergarten simple. Are you ready? It's kindness. But not just any kindness.
The kind of kindness that the world needs is rooted in this deep intention to serve others.
It's much more rooted in an understanding for what people need and a reckoning with my own capacity to meet those people's understandings and needs.
That's Houston Kraft, who is a literal kindness advocate. Houston is the co-founder of Character Strong, which offers a kindness curriculum to schools and communities. He's also a dear friend of ours. And the type of kindness Houston is talking about, the kindness that may change the world, that's what he calls deep kindness.
Deep kindness to me is the willingness to sacrifice to serve others' legitimate needs, as well as our own capacity to discover what's beautiful and worthwhile in ourselves.
If someone says kindness, you probably imagine something transactional. Being nice to strangers, holding open doors, maybe paying for someone's groceries. But deep kindness is different.
Deep kindness requires us to treat people with kindness when we don't feel like it.
That means when you're on this kindness high and you're feeling all psyched to hold the door for someone behind you, that doesn't count. Because it's for you, not for them. And maybe that's why more of us don't do it on a daily basis. It's not always fun or convenient.
If I don't know how to do something, then I'll avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
And the metaphor I always use is the gym. Like, if there's machines in the gym that I don't know how to use, which is most of them, then typically I'll walk towards the ones that I do know how to use, right? Because I don't want to be the person in the gym, which I've been, mm-hmm. who's trying on the machine for the first time, and yeah. it's obvious I don't know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. I think everyone can relate to that moment, too, of like, you know, you're using a machine that's supposed to be for your legs, for your arms or something, and yeah. everyone's staring at you, and you're like, damn it.
Waiting.
Yeah. Yeah. There's somebody waiting to take it after you.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been that way too many times in the gym. And I think that's like one of the initial places we'd experience discomfort is if I don't fully know how to do something, I'm going to lean towards what I do know.
Exhibiting deep kindness is about truly stepping outside of ourselves, which is especially difficult because we're inclined to prioritize our needs and be protective of our time. We're also consumed with efficiency. Kindness can seem like a waste of time.
Most of us have our own stuff going on. Most of us are feeling anxious about something else.
And even when the opportunity to be kind falls right at our feet, many of us won't take it because we're afraid.
There's so many messages for all of us in the world that are going to convince us that we have things to be ashamed of. Mm. And there's so many of those messages that if we believe any of them, they start to create these little lies in our life that actually reduce our capacity for connection.
Basically, we get in our own heads. We need to stop indulging these narratives that we're not good enough and focus on how we can treat other people better. Otherwise, if we're not careful, opportunities to practice deep kindness may slip through our fingers. Houston shared one such story.
I was on the plane. I was exhausted. I wanted to take a nap. This woman shows up, doesn't ask me to stand up, sneaks into the window seat, and she starts pulling things out of her bag, and she's decorating her space, which is a red flag if you've ever traveled before, that you're probably about to have a conversation with this person. This is not going to be a passive plane experience. And sure enough, she taps me on the shoulder. And I asked if she needed something. And she just introduced herself. Hi, I'm Helga.
Houston had great plans for his plane ride. Some music, some reading, some solitude. But Helga wasn't really catching on to the signals he was sending. Eventually, they're in a full-on conversation, talking about life and work. And that's when Houston shared that he'd made kindness a career, even going as far as sharing his origin story about how he started a club back in high school where students would gather weekly to share their experiences with kindness.
And I'm telling Helga the whole story. I look over, she's weeping. And she says, Houston, that's so important. I said, yeah, no, it was great. Met cool people and we had a lot of cool moments. And she goes, no, you don't understand how important that is to me.
Helga launches into the story about the last time she was on an airplane. She lives in Seattle, but that morning, she'd gotten the kind of phone call we all dread. It was from her father's doctor. He was being rushed to the hospital, and they had no idea what was going on. He lived in Arizona, so Helga threw some clothes on and rushed to the airport to get the first flight down. She was in such a hurry that she didn't even pack a bag. As she settled into her seat, she gets another phone call, again, from her dad's doctor.
And her dad's doctor calls to tell her that her dad has passed away. And she goes, Houston, I'm literally on my way to go and see him when I learn that I lost him. And then the phone has to be turned off. Takes off. She's next to strangers for 3 hours. She doesn't say a word. She's pretty much sure she's in shock. She lands in Arizona. She gets off the plane. She's not ready to confront her dad yet. So she walks up to the nearest wall and falls down. She puts her head in her hands and she weeps. And Helga's got a good sense of humor. She said she's not a very pretty crier. So she's wailing in the airport. And she looks at me. She goes, "You want to know why what you're talking about is so important to me? Kindness." She goes, "I waited in the airport that day for 2 hours. I was crying for 2 hours and probably 3,000 people in that airport walked by me. Not one person stopped." And she looks at me. She goes, "You have no idea how much I needed an act of kindness that day."
I bet if we interviewed those 3,000 people who passed Helga in the airport that day, they'd all say that kindness is important. But saying you value kindness isn't the same as acting on it. Every traveler that passed Helga chose their schedule or their comfort over an act of kindness. That doesn't make any of those travelers bad people. They might have been running late for their own flights or just didn't know what to say or do, but that's why it's worth reflecting on. I mean, what would you have done? Would you have stopped? Or would you have kept walking? And if you kept walking, how long would you have regretted it? I know of at least one man who wouldn't have hesitated before approaching Helga. He would have sat right down and listened to her as she expressed her pain. You probably know him too. Perhaps from around the neighborhood?
"It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? It's a neighborly day in this beautiful wood."
On each episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, Fred Rogers, the man, the myth, the literal legend, would go around a fantastical neighborhood where everyone was friends and open about their feelings. One of the neighbors was Officer Clemens, played by an accomplished opera singer named Francois Clemens.
"I tend to think of Fred as the kindest man I've ever known. He had a reservoir of something that it didn't take me too long to feel that it was spiritual, a spiritual kind of kindness. And it was pervasive. I call it Fred love. It is still with us. It's the real thing. And I just talk about kindness. I have to do that all the time, so much so that I've tapped into something very natural in myself. It's very vulnerable. It's very willing to listen and to take my time. There's always enough time."
What I have learned along this journey is that deep kindness goes by many different terms. Francois calls it Fred love. Houston refers to it as deep kindness. And of course, the Dalai Lama praises altruism. No matter what you call it, this essence was the guiding force in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. But the world Fred Rogers crafted was completely unlike the reality that Francois lived in. It was an ideal created to help children imagine a better world. But for Francois, a closeted black man living in 1967, these two worlds were hard to reconcile. While he wanted to play a part in representing Fred's utopia, Francois struggled with the idea of portraying a police officer.
"Unfortunately, I don't think very much has changed between the way policemen behaved back in 65, 70. Not at all. They were very, very cruel, because when the police come, they were generally very aggressive and harsh and abusive. Everybody got hit in the head, even if you were innocent, whatever. It was a terrible thing."
But what Francois did see in the series was the deep kindness of Fred Rogers as an opportunity to represent the world that he actually lived in, not the one that was most commonly represented on TV.
"I looked around and everybody was white except me. You know, this is not Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. This is not the truth."
And he saw the right set of circumstances to share his singing with the world.
What is your hobby, officer?"
"My hobby is sort of my work. I like to sing."
"Oh, of course. Would you sing me some song?"
"I'd be glad to. A song that I'm very fond of is Then Your Heart Is Full of Love. I'll sing that for you."
"Oh, lovely."
"When your heart has butterflies inside it, then your heart is full of love."
But he first had to find a place to live. Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was taped in Pittsburgh. And Pittsburgh wasn't as welcoming or integrated as Oberlin, where he studied in Ohio. This was a surprise to Francois because Pittsburgh...
It's above the Mason-Dixon line. Why can't I find a place to live? I've got the money. I'm black, though. I'm a guy with the money, and I'm black. I ran into that kind of subtle racism a lot. You know, that 80 pounds, 90 pounds that I had on my back the whole time I was trying to run this marathon, and everybody else didn't have anything on, but I had 80 pounds on my back. So when I went to Pittsburgh, there was a naivete that had been slapped out of me. Because having that happen to you, in my opinion, is humiliating. It's not a good feeling. And I mentioned it to Fred. I said, you know, you never, ever would have that experience. Nobody would ever say, oh, Fred Rogers, you can't live here. You're white. You got blue eyes. I'm sorry.
In certain areas of the United States, those double standards were being challenged by more than just Francois.
A man dies when he refuses to stand up for justice. Yeah. A man dies when he refuses to take a stand for that which is true. Yes. So we're going to stand up right here.
A few years earlier, John Lewis and Hosea Williams led 600 civil rights activists in a march from Selma, Alabama to Montgomery, which culminated in Bloody Sunday.
We're going to stand up right here in Alabama amid the billy club. We're going to stand up right here in Alabama amid police dogs if they have them. We're going to stand up amid tear gas. Yes. We're going to stand up amid anything that they can muster up, yes, letting the world know, yes, that we are determined to be free.
Bloody Sunday was captured on film and broadcast all over the country. Bringing the reality of racial violence into the living rooms of millions forced Americans to open their eyes. The hatred and violence were not up for debate. They were appalling.
Many of the issues of civil rights are very complex and most difficult. But about this, there can and should be no argument. Every American citizen must have an equal right to vote.
The event in Selma mobilized Congress to pass the Voting Rights Act, which President Johnson signed into law on August 6, 1965. And as much as that felt like progress, there was still so much work to be done. So when Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood launched locally in February 1968, Francois knew that they could lay important groundwork to educate future Americans about the importance of kindness, acceptance, and tolerance. Then, on April 4th, 1968, Francois and the world needed Fred's love more than ever.
I almost think it was the saddest moment of my life that we had lost Dr. King. What was the movement going to do?
A leading figure of the civil rights movement who preached peaceful, nonviolent protests had been assassinated. And in the wake of his death, a huge void had been left for someone to step into.
And I thought, Fred, you should do something. Why can't you do something? You're Fred Rogers. You're this eminent television personality. And he listened again very patiently. He said, well, everyone's going to respond in some way, Francois, and some of it you will understand and hear and agree with, and others you'll wonder still. But there are things that can be done if you could just be patient.
We'll share how Fred Rogers responded to Francois' call to action after the break. But before that, we should probably tell you that this podcast is produced by Headspace Studios. Headspace has thousands of hours of meditation content. The best tool you have is your mind, so take care of it. After Dr. King's death, there were so many injustices that it was hard for anyone to know which one to address first. While the Civil Rights Act of 1964 had legally ended segregation in schools and public accommodations, Americans were still actively undermining the law, so it was difficult for Francois to be patient. One such example that impacted children was when local communities would close public pools altogether rather than allow black children to swim there. But some community members left the pools open and took it a step further. They would pour bleach over the black swimmers or leave nails at the bottom of the pool.
Sure enough, one day he calls me and said, I've got a script for you. I'm very excited about it for us to work together. I read through that script. I said, there had nothing going on here. We're sitting somewhere with our feet in the water and people over there getting killed.
At first glance, Fred scripted a storyline that wouldn't raise any flags. But upon the second glance, There was a lot of latent meaning behind the scene he constructed. Let's remember that at that time, a white and a black man sharing anything, especially a pool of water, was controversial.
And he said, we're going to share on a deep level, friends, and people may have something to say. Don't pay it any attention. And we went through the scene. As I was going in and say, hi, Fred, how are you? Oh, it's a beautiful day. It's a little hot, you know, we're sweating. And he said, yes, why don't you come on over here and put your feet in the water with me and relax. Okay, all right. I can take a few minutes because it's so hot.
That feels good. Oh, there's Officer Clemens. Hi, Officer Clemens. Come in.
Rogers, how are you?
Fine. Won't you sit down?
Oh, sure. Just for a moment.
It's so warm. I was just putting some water on my feet.
Oh, it sure is.
Would you like to join me?
It looks awfully enjoyable.
So I took the hat off, and I managed to get my shoes off. I rolled up my pants, and I stuck my foot in that water. And when I stuck my foot in the water, I remembered some of the things that Fred and I had been discussing. And one of them was how Jesus washed the feet of the disciples. And so I said, well, Fred, I'm going to have to go. And nobody was more surprised than I was when...
But I don't have a towel or anything.
Oh, you share mine.
Okay.
Sure.
And then he started helping me. And I was kind of stunned. I didn't expect him to reach out that far, you know, metaphysically speaking. And there was something heavy, heavy and warm, real about his attitude as he talked to me. There was a cadence also that spoke to me. And he said, well, friends, what do you think about when you're like this on a day? And I said, well, I think about how many ways to say I love you. And why don't we sing that song? There are many ways to say I love you.
When your heart beats for a special someone, then your heart is full of love.
When I sang the song, I knew I was supposed to be singing it to him, and he was singing it from his heart to me. An iconic scene where we had our feet in the same water. It was a huge shock to a whole lot of white folks that he put his feet in that water with a black man. And he was trying to say, I'm with you. This is not your battle alone. Don't feel like you are alone.
This moment changed how Francois felt about the show forever. This scene of a white man drying a black man's feet, Jesus style, on national television, wiped away any doubts Francois had. He knew that this show touched a hateful world with kindness.
I saw him even on a higher level after that.
Francois and the world shared an epiphany, but the increased public attention forced Francois to live the Mr. Rogers life even off screen. He was gay, and now that America was watching, he felt he had to stay in the closet.
That was the day he put a burden on my back of his philosophy, which was like Dr. King's philosophy. And I felt an enormous responsibility to remain clean, to remain celibate, not to do things that would embarrass him.
Fred knew that Francois was gay and didn't care, but he knew that the public would.
And he said, you know, I love you. I'll always love you. And you'll always be a part of my life. But there are people who will say very, very unpleasant and wrong things about you if they know that you're gay. I don't think the sponsors of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood are ready for an openly gay person. Mm-hmm. I think they would make it very difficult for you. That, to me, ultimately was a great, great kindness. Because the thing that I held on to, I knew he wasn't going to throw me away. And so that, to me, was kindness and a sacrifice.
Fred's stance feels complicated in 2020. While he never threatened to fire Francois because of his sexuality, he also urged him to stay quiet about it. Today, that would be seen as an act of repression, not kindness. But you have to remember, Fred was running a children's television show in the late 1960s, and Fred knew if Francois came out, Fred would not be able to win over support from financiers, and he would be obliterated in the media. To keep Francois safe, to keep his private life intact, Fred vowed to keep his secret. What mattered to Francois in all of this was that Fred didn't love him any less. Fred saw Francois, listened to him, and despite the roadblocks the world put in Francois's way, Fred remained a true friend. On and off camera, his love was unconditional.
Then your heart is full of love.
You have to love your neighbor as yourself. How many times do I have to say it? Kindness. That's all it takes. It doesn't cost any money. It's just an awareness and a willing to reach out and to embrace your neighbors as you would yourself, as you would want to be helped or noticed. We're not going to survive if we're not kind. We're not. We are not, as a society, going to survive if we don't reach out to one another and throw a much broader net.
The bridge between the world we live in now and the world we want to create is paved in acts of deep kindness. And we're reminded through the heroes we deeply respect that it is our actions, not just our ideals, that matter. We've all felt the pull to do something, in the split second between noticing when someone else is in pain and choosing how to respond. There are these sliding door moments like, oh, should I help? Every day we're tested by these very moments. And when those test results come back, they reveal our true values, who we really are, and how we show up in the world. And sometimes what we find is that our actions aren't necessarily aligned with who we purport to be. So it's worth asking yourself,
am I clear enough on what I'm fighting for in regards to something like kindness, that even when I don't necessarily feel like doing it, I've pre-established that my fight is bigger than me?
It's a common misconception that it's easy to be kind, when in actuality, kindness takes real work. It takes conscious practice and self-awareness. I mean, it's risky and uncomfortable to sit with Helga in her pain or to go off script like Mr. Rogers did, and so we often find ourselves taking the easier route, walking by or looking away. The path to a kinder world starts with us, choosing to stop and take notice, especially when it's hard, uncomfortable, and inconvenient. When we have something to lose, that's the kind of altruism the Dalai Lama was getting at. The selfless service of others in their moments of greatest need. Not just smiling at strangers or paying it forward, but leaning into your own humanity. The part inside you that sees Helga and just wants to help, because her pain somehow feels like yours too. So for part one of our challenge today, Houston is suggesting that we sit down and think more about what's getting in the way of kindness for us.
What are the things that you're afraid of, or what are the lies that culture has told you that in believing them prevents you from kindness? And then inconvenience, what are the feelings that you feel on any given day that you think drive you away from kindness?
Part two of our challenge is starting to make kindness a habit.
So identifying something really small that can be done consistently over time. Using the simple example of like my mom writing a note at my lunch every day is a great example of like persistent kindness that starts to stop being something that you just do and it starts to become a part of who you are.
Cooking dinner for your roommates once a week, offering to shop for an older neighbor, sending your parents flowers. Think of one thing you can incorporate as a habit that would make your community a little kinder. I, for one, am totally taking inspiration from Houston's mom, and I'm going to start leaving little love notes for Matt and Amar everywhere. Share your kindness habit with us on Instagram by tagging at YesTheory and using the hashtag YesTheoryChallenge. If you're up for a third challenge, go pick up a copy of Houston's new book, Deep Kindness, which is available online or at your local bookstore. And with that, we'll let Francois take it away.
Cause somebody calling my name, hallelujah.
I'm your host for this episode, Thomas Bragg, but I would not be here without my friends Matt Daher and Amar Kandil. This episode was produced by Joy Folks and Juliette Luini. It was edited by Joey Fishground. Dan Kroll sound designed and mixed it right up. The Yes Theory podcast is produced by Kate Ward for One Day Entertainment. The executive producers are Leah Sutherland, Morgan Seltzer, and Sam Rogaway from Headspace Studios.
What shall I do?